Hey, everybody. Welcome again to F This Movie. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I am joined today for a discussion of 1999's The Mummy by JB.
I have in front of me an ancient scroll, and I'm going to attempt a translation.
That's your iPhone.
Podcasting is only the beginning.
I like it. Hey, you can find our website at fthismovie.net. You can follow us on Twitter. We are at fthismovie. Like our page on Facebook. Listen to us in iTunes by searching fthismovie. If you like the show and you have not yet left a review, please do so. It helps our show and makes us feel good. You can listen to us on Stitcher, and you can email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. Jay Bones.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm doing great.
Are you getting excited about October?
Yes.
It is only a few weeks away.
And I know one of my suggestions was that we should do this now.
Yes.
To sort of tease ourselves. The weather has
kind
gotten...
Kind of a horror movie?
The weather has gotten... No, I think it's a horror movie.
All right.
The weather's gotten a little nippy.
Yeah.
As you yourself said, like a week or two ago. It's happening. The turning of the earth. So consider this a preview for Scary Movie Month, with which this month is going to be very special, because I already know some of the things that Mr. Bromley has in store.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm not going to say anything else.
It's going to be a ton of fun. If you have not yet participated in Scary Movie Month, if you are new to F This Movie since last year, you are really going to have a great time. There's a reason that we all look forward to it all year.
I've been practicing for the Scary Movie Challenge by... Everything I say to my wife has got to be 7 words. I'm trying to get it so that every time I communicate, it's in a short 7-word burst.
Are you as big a freak as I am, where not only are you super excited about October, you're already upset about it being over?
No.
Because that's where I'm at.
No, that's messed up. Yeah, I can get your help with that.
Okay.
Quick shout out to my son. He intends to participate hardcore this year.
I like it.
He is... getting the slate of every movie for the month. He has decided on a sub-theme for himself.
Okay.
I believe it's horror films from the 60s.
Okay.
And I think there's another aspect of it that's even more specific than that. It's like horror films from the 60s that have the word "the" in the title. Or, that's not what it is, but there's some other little codicil.
Okay.
And he has made his friends aware that this is happening.
Good.
And that on any given day... if you come by at night, you can be part of the screening, whether
like
you do the thing or not. So it's our West Coast arm, which right now is comprised of my son and Doug and Heather.
Yeah.
But we have three now, but it's growing exponentially.
Have you seen anything good lately?
Yeah, let's try to keep this to 2 minutes, because that's all it's worth.
Okay.
This could be a whole podcast, as you yourself said. Based on Patrick's interesting review,
thank you.
I sashayed forth Friday night and saw Tusk, and I think that Kevin Smith has long eluded me. That's my bias. I am not a fan of Kevin Smith. I know that's heresy to some. I don't think he's a director. I don't even think he would disagree with that. He's
right.
More of a writer,
right,
who directs to protect his material. I would even argue that he's not so much a writer as a producer of really interesting dialogue.
Okay.
And that maybe his career should have been polishing scripts, but maybe I'm wrong. Clearly, Tusk is not made for me. It seems as though his latest film is made so that people who get really baked can watch it and say, man, that's messed up. A lot of it seems devoted to that.
Okay.
And what's tragic is a little bit less than half of it works. I think... works really well.
Okay.
Because it was, like all good horror films, it was touching me in a way that I didn't want to be touched.
Right.
And I thought the serious parts were incredibly good. And then for whatever reason, and I don't know what that reason is, he withdraws. He pulls back. There's all of this inappropriate comedy.
Yes.
And I can't quite work it out, because if the irony he intends... is that the main character, who's this ironic hipster douchebag,
yeah,
gets his just desserts and
right,
more so, then I can't keep myself from thinking, well, Kevin Smith is an ironic hipster douchebag who even does a podcast. Right. So clearly I'm not inventing things. Is this Kevin Smith's imagined punishment for his own douchebaggery?
I think you've already thought 10 steps beyond what was intended at all.
Because it started as a podcast.
Right.
And as and you get to hear parts of the podcast over the end credits.
Right.
That they're imagining this horror film and they're laughing because they think it's so funny. But the problem is, he makes a horror film where at the heart of it, the plight of the protagonist is horrifying.
Right.
And really affecting.
Yes.
But he doesn't want that to be the movie.
It seems to maybe like it's all supposed to be funny. That and, even I think you and I reacting to it horrified, I think maybe we are wrong.
That if that's the truth, then A, he is without a soul, and B, he underestimated the effect of that makeup.
Yeah.
And Justin Long's performance.
Yeah.
Because I don't think there's anything funny about that.
No, I don't either. I don't
and
know.
And I don't feel Michael Parks is giving a comic performance. Michael Parks is giving one of the most interesting performances I've seen this year.
Yeah, for a lot of it.
And he's...
There's a scene where it's terrible. The flashback. I don't want to say. Oh, do you know what I'm talking about? On the porch?
Well, and then he's playing another idiot to allay suspicion and everything. Right. I felt like it was in his contract that I have to have a scene with this other person.
Right.
As you pointed out in your review, there's something or someone who shows up halfway through, and it's not just me, is it?
No.
It's just...
And again, it literally comes moments after, I think, if I'm remembering correctly, and I could be wrong, the reveal of the makeup.
Yes.
Which I said in the review, I actually wasn't expecting. I didn't think the movie was going to go there. I thought it was going to be this long, drawn out, piece by piece. Okay, I did this to you. Okay, now I did this to you.
Because after the first one, that's what you think. And then it goes incredibly fast to the
it
reveal.
It jumps to the thing. And I was like, holy shit, where are we going from here? And then the answer is to this terrible comedy bit.
It reminded me of a Eugene Levy character from SCTV crossed with Jerry Lewis.
Sure.
And it's another one of these self-satisfied performances that exists for the performer because it goes beyond pulling you out of the movie.
Yeah.
It's this thing.
Yeah. It's a fascinating movie that we could talk about a lot, I think.
It can't decide what it wants to be.
No.
And if it had gone in either way, in either direction, it would have been better.
Right.
But there is something truly disturbing and not just, man, this is so messed up. There's something truly disturbing at the heart of the film that the film has no interest in exploring.
Yeah. It's obviously been very polarizing just from what I've read on Twitter and stuff. And I think a lot of times I get upset when I feel like every movie has become polarizing. And it's like, guys, there's middle ground. But this movie, I think... deserves it. Like, I understand. I don't understand the people that love it, but okay, that's fine. They love it. The people that really dislike it, I think I do understand. And I've seen this interesting thing happen where people are really upset that the movie is based on this joke on a podcast. That, like, oh, he's not even trying. And I mean, I sort of understand where that comes from, but at the same time, I don't know if he had come out in the press and said, like, oh, it's from a dream I had, we would have all accepted that. So who gives a shit where the idea comes from?
And the darker, more serious parts of the film indicate to me that he is trying.
Right. And is capable of doing something that we haven't really seen him do. And then so to see him then throw his hands up and say, ah, but I don't want to do that, or I'm not interested in that, is very frustrating.
I think it needs to decide what it wants to be. I'm glad I saw it.
Sure.
I would welcome any discussion about it because I think I'm right. And and very quickly, and we've seen so many of these films this year, I've been going on and on about Snowpiercer and They Came Together. The Drop.
Yes.
Is really something special, and I don't understand why it's just being...
Remind our listeners what it is, because I think even just saying The Drop, a lot of people are going to say, I've never heard of that.
It is a gritty slice-of-life crime drama. It takes place on the East Coast. I was not familiar, or maybe I was willfully unfamiliar with Tom Hardy's career, but after seeing the film, I realized he played Bane in The Dark Knight Rises, and which is sort of incredible because did they just shave his head for Bane, or were there other things going on too?
They put that mask on him.
Well,
he did that crazy voice.
Sure, and the mask keeps you from seeing his face.
Right.
It was hard for me to believe, even with all of those comic book accoutrements, that he was the guy.
Okay.
And he's got a great American accent, and it's James Gandolfini's last film. And Noomi, we've argued...
Rapace, I believe.
Oh, I thought it was Rapace.
No.
She's in it as well.
No. You just talked me out of seeing it. I have yet to warm to Noomi Rapace. But okay.
No, she's very interesting. And I knew going in that there was some sort of twist. Nope. Knowing that didn't ruin the film for me. It's really great.
Okay.
And one of these films where we gradually learn things and the filmmakers are treating us like intelligent human beings. And there is this sort of twist at the end that makes you rethink the entire film. And it's very good. Now, of course, Patrick will go see it.
Yeah.
And just come back, and the next time I talk to you, you'll be shaking your head. But we had a choice of three or four of these sort of lesser advertised films
right,
that morning,
right.
And that's the one we picked. And the whole way home, we were like, I'm so glad. And I think some of our listeners can identify with this. We didn't get burned.
Yeah, right.
We didn't get burned.
So nice to be pleasantly surprised. Did you get to see A Walk Among the Tombstones yet?
No.
Okay. It's good. You should see it.
My son saw that at a screening with the director at AFI and was disappointed because he thought for what it was, it was really good.
Yeah.
But some of his classmates were sort of treating it as damaged goods because it's a genre film that's not aspiring to, you know.
Right.
They were being very dismissive of it, and Jake said it's certainly not the type of film I enjoy, but I understood that for what it was trying to do, it was really good.
It's good. There's an aspect of it, and I'll have a review up by the time this podcast comes out. There's an aspect of it that I think is very problematic, and I won't talk about what that is, but yeah, it's Scott Frank, and he's really good. This is only the second movie he's directed.
I love, what's the other one?
The Lookout.
Is he mostly known as a writer?
Yeah.
What else has he written?
He wrote Dead Again. We talked about this offline.
Okay.
But,
because at the screening, Jake said he brought up Dead Again.
Right.
I guess at these things, Jake has a habit of bringing up other...
lesser known.
Right. And then more often than not, the professional person is like, oh, and gets really excited because they like to talk about that. Scott Frank actually said that working with Branagh spoiled him because Branagh's from the theater where you take the script very seriously and the writer, you don't change things willy-nilly. And in fact, Branagh invited him to be on the set and welcomed his participation because, of course, if you're secure in your own talent, how could that hurt to have the guy who wrote it? But Frank said that just spoiled him because other productions aren't like that.
He wrote Get Shorty. He wrote Out of Sight. He wrote Minority Report. I mean, he's got some good credits.
And I admire the fact, you know, going along with this whole Snowpiercer, the drop, they came together discussion, that they're really advertising A Walk Among the Tombstones well. Because what is it now? How many years? They're still advertising it as Taken.
Right. And it's already, you know, the box office has come in. It came in second. It made some money, not as much as, you know, these Liam Neeson movies usually open really strong.
Yeah.
And it was disappointing because it's better than the Liam Neeson movies we've been getting. And so, of course, it didn't make money.
When I walk among the tombstones, I have a very specific set of skills. I mean, that's the trailer, basically.
He gets a scene on the phone where he threatens somebody. I mean, he just keeps doing it.
That's in his contract now.
I finally watched 3 Days to Kill, which Adam Riske has been talking up for much of this year. Kevin Costner playing a hitman who's dying of a brain tumor.
I think you tweeted that he was wearing scarves that were...
In every scene, he's wearing a scarf.
That were very distracting to you.
Yeah, it's not even that the scarf is distracting. I just was distracted by the fact that why is Kevin Costner constantly wearing scarves in this movie?
That's in his contract now because you get to keep your wardrobe.
It's directed by McGee, And it's not good. I don't know. No offense to Adam. He and I just don't agree on this one because...
I didn't see it. The trailer made it look entertaining.
It's not. It takes itself pretty seriously. Like, for as ridiculous as so much of it should be, I found it really trying to, like, be this serious movie about this father-daughter relationship. His daughter's played by Hailee Steinfeld.
Oh.
And that takes all that stuff really seriously. It's on Netflix. You can watch it, you know, no risk. And
it's on instant streaming now.
It is. That's why I saw it finally. I was expecting...
The trailer made parts of it almost look like a comedy. Like, right. He's trying to do almost, not Daddy Daycare, but like... Where you expect the record to scratch at any minute, right, that he's an international hitman, right, and he's watching his daughter for the weekend.
And it tries to do that movie, and I don't think it does that particularly successfully. I saw a movie called Afflicted, which is a horror movie that came out, I don't know, this year, last year? It's a found footage movie about two friends who are filming their trip together. One of them is, I don't think this is a spoiler, gets bitten by a woman that he hooks up with and starts to go through changes. I'm so burned out on found footage, and it reminded me so much of, did you see Chronicle?
No.
They become superheroes. It's found footage, but they become superheroes. Some amazing special effects, and you react differently to special effects. There's a scene where this character just like jumps really high and starts climbing a building. And if you were to see that in any Hollywood movie, you would say, well, I've seen that in every movie. But for some reason, through that found footage aesthetic, it becomes more impressive. I think because you're not expecting special effects. Beyond that, I don't have a ton that's positive to say about the movie. Low budget, hey, good for them, but I did not love it. Again, just found footage is...
Someone needs to bury that genre with, I'm thinking, a comedy where the survivors, there are people who died in various ways, and the survivors are putting the film together with found footage, and like not all of it is about... like the scary thing.
Right.
Like they find other things maybe. I don't know. Someone needs to bury the genre. Someone needs to make fun of it in such a way that the minute you tried to do it again, the first thing that would come to people's mind would be the parody.
And when he was introducing Willow Creek, Bobcat Goldthwait talked a little, made a joke about found footage that, you know, most of these movies kind of end the same way where everybody's dead and that's, you know, why this footage was lost or whatever. And he said, like, that the aesthetic is ridiculous. Like, oh, sorry, your family died, but we got this movie out of it. Or, you know, can we cut that footage together? It's ridiculous. And then finally I saw a movie called Honeymoon, which is a horror, independent horror movie. That's out in limited release right now. It's available on VOD. I think by the time this podcast comes out, Adam Risky's review will be up at ifthismovie.net. About a couple that is on their honeymoon in a remote cabin, and the wife, whose name is, I want to say, Rose Leslie. I think I have that wrong. She's on Game of Thrones. She goes out walking one night and comes back, and she's changed. And then the rest of the movie is about how she has changed. It's not found footage, so that's good. Again, I didn't love it. I appreciate that it's trying to do some different things, and Adam Risky actually, his review says some interesting things about what he thinks the movie should have, could have, almost was.
Is she turned into a walrus?
She's not, sadly. Sadly, she is not. Not the worst movie, not the best. So I haven't seen anything that I can really get excited about.
Trailers are no indication of quality, but Friday night when I went to see Tusk, I saw a trailer for The Canal.
Okay.
It's
not familiar with it.
From England.
Okay.
It has nothing to do with Women in Black.
Okay.
Except it's got the same creepy vibe. We're going to play by the rules. We're not going to have obnoxious things jumping out to big orchestra stings. That we're gonna create a mood of foreboding. I'm very excited. That's the one now for October that I'm looking forward to. There is a boatload of horror films coming out.
Finally,
most of them on October 24th because it's the weekend before.
Finally, that seems. I mean, I know a lot of them are like smaller independent stuff, but
hey, guys,
every year we complain about,
get your shit together.
Right. Why aren't they putting out horror movies in October? I know the new VHS comes out in October, which surely you're excited about.
Well, it's become a tradition.
Of course.
That, in fact, this should be a movie like Tusk. Every year, you force me to sit down and watch one of these things.
They're interesting.
Oh,
they're not always good.
Oh, no.
They're interesting. And Safe Haven, come on.
Worth it alone. I don't begrudge you. Because there are a couple sequences that are good.
Yeah.
In fact, in both of them, there are sequences that are good. I'm just thankful that you didn't make me watch that ABC's movie.
Oh, yeah. That's coming out, too. The sequel to that is coming out, I think, in October.
What's it
going to
be called? The Number Line?
It's the ABCs of Death 2. For real. 26 new directors.
Oh,
26 new ways to die. I'm not excited, but it did just screen, at Fantastic Fest. And, the consensus seems to be much better than the last one. So that's good because I was not a fan of the original.
We finally got our letters together. A drive-in by our house is showing three of the classic Universal films the weekend of October 24th.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm hoping to go to that, although I think Adam Riske has already thrown cold water on that by suggesting that, as the sun goes down, you're going to see the Samsung logo on the screen.
Yeah.
And you're going to realize that you've driven for an hour.
Hey, should we talk at all? I want to talk about The Mummy, but should we talk about Texas Chainsaw Massacre at all?
Yes.
There will be a podcast that talks a little bit more in depth about that movie and or that series later in October, but JB and I did see the 4K restoration a week or two ago.
And I had seen the 4K restoration, supposedly, the week before,
right,
on a drive-in screen where you reach the conclusion, was Texas Chainsaw made on 16 and then blown up?
I don't know.
I have a sneaking suspicion that that might be the case. So we have 16 blown up to 35, and you've seen it all sorts of ways, and now there's a 4K restoration of what might not be 35 millimeter original elements, and now they're showing them on a drive-in screen. So it was past my bedtime, and I only watched it for about 20 minutes just to see what it looked like, which was impossible on a drive-in screen.
Right.
And so the next week, we sallied forth to the Music Box Theater, the happiest place on earth, and saw the 4K restoration of Texas Chainsaw.
Which is now available on Blu-ray and DVD, I think, as of this week. That transfer has now come out.
Which is sitting on my pile, but I haven't spun it yet.
It's weird that you call your bed your pile. What did you think? I know what you meant.
No, my feces.
Oh.
Sitting. I thought you'd... No.
I'm sorry.
It's affectionate. You know, my pile. I'm sorry. I thought you knew that.
What did you think of the 4K restoration? I guess we could talk about that if we're not going to talk about the movie.
I didn't think it made any difference.
I don't know that I did either.
I was glad that it wasn't grainy or dark because I've seen... I mean, I think I go back to, I even think the first time I saw it was at a drive-in.
Okay.
The late lamented 53 drive-in. And every possible VHS, DVD iteration. And how many times has that goddamn thing come out?
Quite a few.
Right? So, again, I think there's only so far you can tweak it. Because I don't think the original... This was a guerrilla film made on the fly by some young amateur filmmakers who were trying to make a name for themselves. I appreciated the fact that there were no splices or jump cuts or anything like that. What struck me most, and I think I mentioned this as we left the theater, I hadn't seen it in a really long time, and now I'm an old man. I was surprised by how short it is.
Okay.
And how mean-spirited and relentless it is. I've always known.
Right.
I mean, it is what it is.
Right.
But I was struck by just how relentless that last half hour is.
Yeah.
And obviously, that's one of the reasons why the film is famous.
It's a movie that I appreciate a lot more than I like, which is surprising because, again, I'm a pretty big Tobe Hooper fan. But
I think I give it so much credit because I was sitting there sort of disappointed because, again, I'm going with my memories of it from when I was 30 or something. And you get to that last shot, and I'm willing to forgive a lot because that last shot of the dance, lack of a better word, but almost like the Godzilla thing that came out this summer, imagine if the entire film was as disturbing and beautiful and inspired.
Right, sure.
Imagine if they had been able, because there's one shot in Godzilla I like. Oh, by the way, before I forget.
Yeah.
It either came out on Blu-ray last Tuesday.
I believe so.
And the one shot that everyone agrees is just, it's in the commercial. For
is
the
it? Well, there
so
you go.
So there you go. Thank you for that.
I had heard going into this Texas Chainsaw restoration that the big difference, the really great thing about it was the sound design, that they had, you know, done this remix of the sound. And again, seeing the movie in a theater, I didn't think the sound was like, I wasn't like, oh my gosh, that does make a huge difference. Again, until that last shot, which was so loud that you almost had to hold your hands over your ears, maybe because it was 1:30 in the morning. But the sound of that saw in the last scene was pretty impressive.
And I don't even know if I want to. Can I tell our listeners this?
I guess. I have no idea what he's going
to
say.
So,
everyone,
it was so embarrassing. It was so embarrassing because everyone's a little tired. It was a midnight show. It was 1:30 in the morning, and as that shot hit the screen, I mean, it's the best shot in the entire film. Patrick yelled in the theater, go ahead, cuz, do your stuff.
Oh, yeah, do your thing, do your thing. Do your thing. Yeah, it was late. I know you couldn't remember. Yeah, it just seemed like the right moment to say those immortal words. So let's talk about The Mummy from 1999, which hasn't, I don't think, been formally requested at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com, although one of our listeners, I want to say El Gaith, which is Spanish for the Gaith.
The whole time I was watching the film,
yeah,
whenever they showed George Harrison, which is what I call that one character,
okay,
because he looks exactly like George Harrison.
Really?
That El Gaith's little icon is that character.
Yeah, he's a huge, huge fan of this movie, so we want to do it justice. I'm sure he'll be excited that we're doing a whole podcast on it.
And I hadn't seen it in a dog's age.
It had been a while for me.
I watched it this morning.
Okay.
I had a 9 a.m. matinee.
And what'd you think?
I enjoyed the hell out of it.
Yeah, it's a fun movie.
I love the movie, although again, because I hadn't seen it in a while, I was very surprised by the one thing I don't think works anymore.
Which is?
Because I think when it came out, that's what made people like it.
Which is what?
The ILM-y quality of many of the special effects.
Okay.
And we're now at a point where we've had CGI for quite a while.
Yeah.
That, who would have thunk, because when CGI started, it was, oh, this is,
right.
Oh,
right.
Yes, oh, that as the technology progresses, that dates the movie, for me, more than anything in the original Dracula or The Mummy or Frankenstein. And again, The Mummy is at this point where it's, I wouldn't say it's an even mix, but there's plenty of practical effects.
Yes. And I think that's okay. So I had almost the opposite reaction because I was expecting it to date much worse. Any movie that was kind of CGI heavy in the 90s has generally not held up that well. There's a window from like 96 to 99 where movies will use a lot of CGI and it just wasn't there yet, you know. Now, The Mummy came out the same year as The Phantom Menace, which I don't think, it's still not good, but I don't think the effects have dated because that's so state of the art that I think the effects still hold up in The Phantom Menace. So people were still doing it well in 99.
Well, maybe the A-Team was working on Phantom
Menace. Yeah. I was expecting it to date much more poorly because in my memory, the effects didn't hold up. But I think what I'm remembering is every other Stephen Sommers movie ever made, which has a ton of CGI, all of it bad. I mean, The Mummy sequel, Van Helsing, even G.I. Joe, bad CGI in all those movies. So the fact that there was so much more practical stuff than I remember made it sort of a pleasant surprise. I agree that some of the real CGI heavy stuff when he's in that sort of middle stage of transformation isn't great, but it was so much better than I was expecting it to be that it was kind of a pleasant surprise for me.
The litmus test for me was fairly early in the film when the Rick O'Connell character is first at Hamunaptra. They do this wonderful thing with compressed air, and they make the sand fly up in a circle. It's circling him, mm-hmm. and you can tell. I don't know. It's just you can tell it's a practical effect.
Right.
That there's
right.
actually an airline right. under the sand.
Right.
And they work this out and it's wonderful. And it's kind of chasing him. And the camera placement and Brendan Fraser's performance, and it's all been choreographed and it's very wonderful. And then the camera swings up and the big, you know, cherry on top of the sundae is one of the first CGI effects in the film, which is the sand descends and forms a face.
Right.
And that's not nearly as effective right. as the right. as the chasing.
And that's
the sand.
Sort of one of the more iconic shots from the movie. I remember a lot of the marketing being built around this sand face.
And while we're on the subject of the sand face, before I forget.
Which is what the movie was originally called. Sand face is only the beginning.
Well, that's an interesting joke because it seems to me at some point someone had limited imagination because a lot of the film revolves around Arnold Vosloo or sand Arnold Vosloo or halfway to being
right.
Arnold Vosloo opening his mouth
right.
in a very scary way. There's right. a bunch of shit about with sure. the plane and he's scaring, and then there's a scene where all the little soldiers scare Brendan Fraser, and then Brendan Fraser like he yells at them and then yeah. he screams back
yeah.
that this film is obsessed with the mouth. that for some reason that's what they keep going back to. I did some research
okay.
about the genesis of this film.
I believe I did as well.
And boy, Universal, talk about long-range plans. We're gonna do something.
Yeah.
But it's in development hell, and every earlier iteration sounded fascinating.
Yeah.
Like a film I'd want to see. And it went through lots of directors and lots of writers.
Yeah.
And they originally envisioned it as a low-budget film.
Right.
Written by Clive Barker.
Right.
That would have focused on the obsessive love.
Right.
And then it
more of a remake of the original, I think.
Yeah. Although, and this is the only Stephen Sommers film I like.
Sure.
He really seems to have affection
yes.
for this.
Yes.
Certainly more than, I mean, let's not talk about Van Helsing. And I even see three scenes in This Mummy that are him specifically calling out the mm-hmm. original.
Mm-hmm.
And those were the scenes that touched him. And we can argue are really some of the better scenes in the Boris Karloff original. And he comes up with sort of fresh ways of doing it in this. So I like the fact that he's sort of tipping his hat. And then it goes to Joe Dante. And I guess the Dante version came very close yeah. to yeah. being greenlit.
Yeah.
And that was with a script by John Sayles.
Right.
And then Dante falls out and it goes to Mick Garris.
Romero was before.
That's right.
Maybe even Dante.
That's right. Romero is involved.
But again, think of the names that are attached to Clive Barker, George Romero, Joe Dante, even Mick Garris. I mean, every one of those is like, I would see that movie.
I would see a mummy movie.
So thank God that the one that they made is actually good and we like it.
And because Stephen Sommers has the one good idea he's
yeah.
ever had
yeah.
in his professional career. And I wrote that silly column with the pictures a couple months ago where Universal is now talking about imagining a universe where the
of
monsters
course,
are like the Avengers.
Everything is a universe.
And what might that be like? But this is the exception that proves the rule, that Indiana Jones meets the Mummy could have gone really bad. And I don't think it does here. I think the fun stuff works. I think the broad stuff works. And I'm watching it again, and I'm sort of bouncing this idea off my lovely wife. I think the reason the approach here works is that the Mummy is always serious.
Okay.
The Mummy's never a joke. The Mummy is truly a threat. And in fact, these somewhat over-the-top comic book characters become a little bit more serious in approaching the
mm-hmm,
threat.
Mm-hmm.
At no point is there ever a stupid joke where...
Right, right.
You know, Rick manages to rip his robe off, or I don't know, some
right.
ridiculous thing like
right.
that. That the threat is taken seriously, that once Stephen Sommers comes aboard, they exponentially increase the budget.
Which I thought was funny, that it was like they were looking to spend around $15 million, and then Stephen Sommers has his idea, and they're like, okay, we'll change it to $80 million.
And even though apparently 15 of that is special effects, I'm watching this movie and the money is on the screen.
Yeah.
That opening sequence with all of the Foreign Legion on horseback, it's the return of the long shot. And even though the first shot in the film is that sort of early CGI
right.
recreation of the Egyptian town, and I watch it and it looks like that part of the video game that's not the video game,
right.
but is
cut
meant
scenes,
to
I think they call yeah, this. Yeah,
that it looks like that. But even I'm watching that and I'm like, one thing I miss in movies made in the 60s is movies with scope,
right.
like Lawrence of Arabia, which right. this film has a shout out to. There was a sense of scale mm-hmm. and of trying to wow you with how big things were. And yeah. that happened several times in The Mummy.
Yeah, it was. I remember seeing it in 99. And I know Doug and I, a couple of weeks ago, in talking about American Beauty, we're talking about what a year 1999 was. I mean, if you look at the movies that came out in 99, you just will not believe how many good movies came out. And this was sort of the first summer blockbuster. And I had low expectations based on a number of things. And went to see it the weekend it opened and was like, oh my gosh, that was so much fun.
Yes.
And I was not expecting it to be so much fun. And who knew that trying to turn it into this sort of big adventure movie would work so well. And so revisiting it was actually a pleasant surprise again, because I was sure that it wasn't going to age well, that the spell was going to wear off, that it was going to be like, well, the weekend it opened in the summer, that was fun because of when I saw it, but now it's not going to work. And I think the movie still does really work well.
Which I'm now beginning, the more I read about They Came Together, the more I think that it wove a spell on us
maybe,
that night
maybe.
In that one theater with that
sure,
one crowd.
Sure.
And we're the outliers. The Blu-ray looks stunning.
Yeah.
And that's a film that they've re-released several times.
Yeah.
This time I was very aware of the score.
Okay.
And I'm not Mr. Movie Score guy, but the score works really well, I think. And my memory, you said you went the opening weekend. I believe I did too. It was the first time Jan and I ever went to a movie theater that served food.
Oh, okay.
Which back then was Yorktown. That right. was this experiment, this bold experiment.
Right.
Bogart's at Yorktown. And we actually played the game where there's a little restaurant and you can eat in the little restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have dessert in the theater. And all the popcorn was free, which I was impressed by because I don't think you people realize how much popcorn I can eat. But we're having our dessert in the theater. And at this point, Jan is slapping her face listening to the podcast because we've told the story to pets.
This is the movie?
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
That we've never been to one of these restaurant theaters before, and we are watching the beginning of The Mummy and enjoying the hell out of it, and we're having this little dessert, and my wife happened to have a full cup of hot coffee, and that opening scene with Evie, where her brother plays the... I was astounded at how well
yeah.
that's done, watching
yeah.
it now, because obviously I know what's coming, both in the way it's shot... In the build up to it, in the weird sound effect they put over it, and my wife went ah, which is the desired reaction, and spilled hot coffee all over herself, which was not the intended. I mean, that's scary in a very real way, third
right.
degree burn.
Right.
She wasn't hurt, but that's something we will remember forever.
Brendan Fraser is not terribly discerning when it comes to choosing movies.
No.
Makes a lot of bad movies.
Yes.
And is often bad in them.
Yes.
In a way that's very sort of broad and muggy. And gets a bad rap, and rightfully so, I think. But then every once in a while, a movie will come along, and you'll say, oh my gosh, he's capable of being really good.
There are several parts, and watching The Mummy, I kept thinking about Gods and Monsters.
Yeah.
And I think he's very good in that.
He is very good in that. And he has a handful of movies that you point to and say, like, okay, no, that justifies the next, you know, five or six. What was that movie he was in where the animals were attacking him? Furry Vengeance, is that right? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Vaguely.
Oh, definitely go home and Google the trailer for Furry Vent. He's like furry. Maybe a developer who wants to...
Oh, and the animals.
And the animals go after him, and he has wide eyes and screams.
Would this be late career?
Brendan Fraser? This is only a couple of years ago.
My only problem with Brendan Fraser and The Mummy is he's much better at the goof than the Indiana Jones.
Okay.
There's a gravity that part could have that is lacking.
See, I think his performance is in the spirit of the movie. I think he's goofy and fun and kind of doing this winking macho thing. But I think, you know, when he's called upon to shoot two guns and be kind of a tough guy, I think he sells it.
And I think that works. And again, this is a quibble because I think this is his best performance, probably.
Maybe.
That it's just a little tweak that when you're watching Indiana Jones, the three good ones, the one good one.
I watched Temple of Doom a couple months ago. I liked it a lot more than when we watched it that one day.
There's an undercurrent to Harrison Ford in those movies.
Yeah.
That's not a joke.
Yes. I agree with that.
The great scene in the first one where Denham Elliott says, this isn't to be taken lightly.
Right. But I think those movies have a different tone than the Mummy. I think The Mummy's very light. I think those movies are light, but I think there's something more going on underneath.
I read when the film came out, it received criticism for its racial stereotypes.
Yeah.
Specifically, and I'm having a hard time remembering the character's name, the rat-like jail warden who comes along with them to protect his investment.
Okay.
And Evie's brother is commenting on how bad the tomb smells, and then he realizes it's that guy coming down the rope.
Right.
But we're watching this, and I'm kind of trying to gauge if it's racist, but I'm an old white man, so maybe I'm not the best judge. But my wife pointed out that the first time we meet the Americans on the boat, you could argue that that's sort of stereotyped.
Right.
That they're louts and they're violence happy and they're gun, they're trigger happy. So I don't know. The other thing about the performances, just before I forget, I think his name is Alan Simpson, and he's the Egyptologist who discovers the black book.
Okay.
He wears a fez and he treats the help very poorly.
Yeah.
I wish he was given a little bit more to do.
Sure.
Because some of the Americans actually have more to do, like get their eyes and tongue ripped out. Because he's in Jumanji and he's one of my favorite parts of Jumanji. He's the father and the big game hunter.
Yeah.
And it's such a throwaway.
Yeah.
Although he does get the shot that was in the trailer where he's holding the book and he's covered with locusts.
Oh, yeah.
And he says something
that's
made for the trailer.
I actually think, Brendan Fraser carries it, and John Hannah is fine as the brother, but he's one of these characters whose every line is a comic relief line.
And every time I see him, like a neon sign in my head, the poor man's Hugh Grant.
Kevin J. O'Connor, who was sort of Stephen Sommers' muse for a little while, is another one of these guys who's like, every line is a joke and everything's supposed to be funny. The Americans are all kind of generic. Again, Brendan Fraser kind of carries it. And Rachel Weisz, I think, is so good in this movie.
Yes.
In a way that she's not, hasn't really had an opportunity to be before or since.
They were smart enough to hire an English stage actress.
Right.
But, and maybe this is also related to the Blu-ray transfer, which I was just talking about. I watched The Mummy this morning, and she is so staggeringly beautiful.
Yeah.
It kind of makes it hard to pay attention.
Right.
To the plot
but she sells the serious stuff. You know, she's kind of there to be the one to explain, like, no, this is important. This is okay. And she sells that, but she's also like kind of funny and gets to do like some physical comedy, and she doesn't get to do a lot of this stuff. And this is one of the last movies where she was, there's a lot of actresses who have to play this part a bunch of times before they get the thing that kicks them up to the next level.
And everyone agrees this was her breakthrough.
Yeah.
Because this movie made a lot of money.
Yeah. And now it ends up being like Gemma Arterton or just somebody who like 5 years from now, maybe they break and then you look back and you say, oh, I remember when they were doing this kind of, you know, second banana in the Hollywood blockbuster movie. But yeah, she elevates the movie, I think. Without her, I don't think the movie works nearly as well.
And I appreciate from the standpoint that Stephen Sommers wrote it, that he wrote this character that's far more Marion Ravenswood than that Cape Capshaw
Willie Scott
in the second one. Because I think in most movies we get Willie Scott and not Marion Ravenswood.
Yeah, definitely. I wonder,
it's better if she's smart.
Right.
It works so much better.
And doesn't just make him a total stooge either. I mean, he's goofy, but it's not like, it doesn't turn into the sitcom where like the wife is smart and the husband is a heavyset fool who just wants to watch sports. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
That dynamic could have very easily happened as well just by turning Brendan Fraser into a clown. And he's clownish, but he has this moment that is the moment that I remember still. And every time it comes, it never fails to make me smile. And it's at the end of the movie when he takes out a couple of the undead and he turns to her and does this kind of look like, hey, mummies. And like... that sells the movie in such a way that,
and he says that that's the line.
Just mummies. It's the best thing ever. His delivery is perfect, and again, it really indicates that like Stephen Sommers knew exactly the movie he was making, and he really grasped the tone. And he has not done that since. I mean, it makes me so sad to see this movie and think, oh, here's a guy who could have been like Michael Bay. For people with hearts and souls, like who love these old movies and who love the way that he's kind of paying tribute to them. And it all got away from him so quickly, but this is the one that makes it seem like he could have been something.
And his love of old movies is so evident in every frame. In that opening sequence when, Aksunamun and Imhotep, kill the Pharaoh.
Yes.
And suddenly, it's the big shadow on the
wall.
And
he does it a couple times.
Oh, yeah.
They do the shadow then, later with the American.
And then when he's...
When he shrivels down, it's great.
When Aksunamun kills herself, that's in shadow.
Yes.
And then later at the end, there's a callback to that.
Yes.
One of the most affecting shots in the Boris Karloff original is once he's discovered and he's condemned to this horrible punishment, they show them wrapping his head in bandages after he's had his tongue torn out, and Karloff's eyes sell it, and everyone in the audience is sitting there, well, you've had your tongue torn out. That's not the worst part of this. And Sommers repeats that shot. It's it almost looks like the Karloff original colorized. And then actually goes farther, because now it's 1999 and you don't have to worry about the production code, that any thought about what that would actually be like. And later we get the callback to it, because they open the tomb and Evie starts saying, oh, look, that he was trying to claw his way out.
Right.
And those scarabs take a really long time to eat you. You know, that's something that we don't talk about a lot, when the horror film is able to do that and get under your skin.
Right. Like Tusk.
Well, driving here, I thought, you could really make a comparison between the two, but you can't.
Right.
They're too different. But the stuff that's meant to be disturbing and not just laugh, mess, that's so messed up. The stuff that's disturbing in Tusk is really disturbing and hard to take.
Yeah.
And I appreciate the fact that in this sort of Indiana Jones knockoff amusement park ride, the movie later became an amusement park ride.
Yeah.
Here's my amusement park ride story. One weekend, I decided to take my son to Universal. I think he was 9 or 10. We just went for the weekend. Tons of fun. Dad and Jake. And they had just opened the Mummy ride. And we got in line. And the Mummy ride is not very forgiving for people of a certain size. But that was like 15 years ago. And I was close. Two amusement park employees grabbed the bar and pulled it back, and I'm sucking in and I'm breathing in, and they're like, sir, just one more click, just one more. They really wanted me to ride. Sir, just one more click. Have you been on the ride?
Not the one. I was on one that you walk through. It was like a haunted house that you walk through out in California. And I hate haunted houses, and so I let this Asian couple walk in front of me, and everything jumped out. It scared them, and I just held back.
And you could watch it like a movie.
Exactly.
The ride is terrific. It's short, but it's wonderful. They recreate the ceiling of fire.
Okay.
They recreate the scarabs. It's tons of fun. So I've been on it.
Yeah.
But since then, every time I've tried, it's a no-go. You can't, like, design one car at the end of the train that's for Fatty McFatFat. But here's the thing for all of our plus-size listeners. Get in line with your friends. Go through the line or whatever it is, because you got nothing to lose. What are you going to do? You're going to go do something while you want to stay with your group. When it's clear you can't ride, they will apologize to you and hand you a coupon so that you can skip the line at another ride.
Well, there you go.
So now I do that every time just to get the coupon, and the joke's on them.
I guess, but the time you spend in line, isn't it a wash?
Well, what would I be doing?
I guess.
It's not, but
you're waiting in line for something you can't ride so that you don't have to wait in line for something you can.
But we didn't wait in line for the mummy, and that's a whole other story.
Ah, got it.
It's
all right.
Listen. Send me an email and I will send you JB's tips for going to the amusement park with a fat friend.
I don't like, I'm skeeved out anytime there's stuff in movies where something crawls under someone's skin, and this movie does it a lot. And the only thing that saved me this time was, again, that the bad CGI, that you can see even the CGI skin is fake looking. And so I was just grabbing onto that because I'm not a fan of that. Gives me the skeeves.
But it's another example of something the film keeps doing, and I was commenting on this time, and it's like the number one rule of screenwriting: show, don't tell.
Yeah.
From the very beginning of the film, things happen. Interesting things happen. And
imagine that.
That's how Summers wants us to learn about the characters.
Right.
You get that amazing Buster Keaton gag with the bookshelves.
Right.
And that's a tour de force. But we learn something about her. And when the scarab goes under the skin of the brother...
Right.
It's Rick who steps forward and almost instantly cuts. I mean, because he doesn't even know what happened to the last guy.
Right.
I remember the first time I saw this, those scarabs really. And I think it's their sound.
Yeah.
And watching it at home with decent sound turned pretty far up. There's a couple scenes in the tomb where whoever did the sound design has a wonderful feeling for Halloween. There are scenes that have nothing to do with the scarabs where at one point or another we can hear a couple of them in the background, that clickety click noise they make. Those are hard to watch.
It's cool because my son is still too young for this movie. I think there's some things that would
I agree completely
upset him. It's a PG-13, but I think in a few years, like, this is a good, I think, gateway movie into horror, because it's fun and it's light, but there are some things that are kind of scary, and it's called The Mummy, and you could say, you know, it was based on this other thing, and then you show the other thing, but
which you could take the the explanation of the rating at the beginning of the film is really funny.
I didn't see it. They have
the little phrase.
Yeah.
It's constant action. There's a word in there. It's like the rating system is being condescending. Constant comic book violence and partial nudity.
Really?
Because of Devin DeVasquez or whatever her name is.
Sure.
Do I have her name right?
Not even a little. Nadine? No.
No.
Shit.
She was a Playboy Playmate.
That's not her. Patricia Velasquez.
Yeah.
Was a Playboy Playmate?
Yep.
Devin DeVasquez was. She's in Society.
Oh.
That's who you're thinking of.
Are they sisters?
I don't think so, because one has a different last name. Nadine Velasquez. No, damn it, Patricia Velasquez.
She's not given a whole lot to do.
Yeah.
She
has more to do in the second one, I think. They bring her back.
Which I want to talk about in just a second. The end, when she's all covered with bandages and Fuller's Earth, do you think that's her under there?
I don't know.
I wonder if they wanted her to do that.
Yeah, I don't know.
Here's my question.
Yes,
big spoilers for The Mummy 2, which you don't want to see ever.
The Mummy Returns?
Yeah.
Yeah.
This, of course, is before Rachel Weisz turns into Maria Bello. It was a magic trick. The mummy did it. He's magic. Given what happens to Benny, given what happens to Kevin J. O'Connor, He's back in the sequel, isn't he?
I don't remember him being back.
Okay.
But he might be. But I don't remember him being back.
The scarabs swarm.
Right.
His torch runs out. We hear a scream.
Right.
And I'm watching it knowing they made a sequel.
Right.
And that Benny was one of the more famous elements of the original.
Right.
And I wondered if, like, when he shows up in the sequel, and I don't remember the sequel at all.
I don't either. I remember being very disappointed.
I've pushed it out of my memory.
Again, it's the movie that this one could have been, and you know. It's...
That there's a way they could have brought him back.
Sure.
But speaking of bringing someone back.
Yes.
Elle Gates' icon.
Yes.
George Harrison.
Yes. Oded Ferrer.
Is he in the sequel?
I'm pretty sure.
Okay, because this isn't original to me. This is my lovely wife, and I think she's on to something. All hell breaks loose. It's like the end of a James Bond film, because the evil Wonderland, the evil... the place, the bad guy's lair has to implode, and so we'll have another 3,000 years. We'll know, okay. And there's a lot of cool explosions, and they get away. It screams studio interference and reshoot, because you can almost see the join. Boom, boom, everything. Oh, sand in the air. Everything's cascading in on itself. And then we cut to them. Oh, we got away. It's so great. And then there's a hand on the brother's shoulder. He thinks it's the mummy. We pull back. It's the guy.
Right.
Thank you very much for helping me, and may Allah be with you. And then he rides off.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a beat. And then the brother says something like, everything I ever do comes to nothing. You can easily see where everything's crashing in on itself. And then we cut to the brother saying that. Could they have done that? Because the fate of that character is semi-undecided, and someone decided that that would be a good character. It's really strange. It's very weird the way it's filmed.
Okay.
Because earlier in the film, you just assume Rick threw dynamite down that alley.
Right.
I don't know.
I don't know. I don't see Stephen Sommers killing that character off arbitrarily.
So plus, maybe. we later learn he's the narrator of the beginning of the film.
So maybe he just kind of botched the way he shot that one scene. This is a great movie, too, if you ever want to show somebody what shooting day for night looks like. Because holy shit, they do it a lot in this movie.
I also liked how we meet Rachel Weisz's boss.
Yes.
And he's a certain way. And some things happen. And then later, something's revealed that if you know it in advance, makes you look at that opening scene completely differently.
Okay. You can spoil it. I mean, it's...
Okay. We learn he's part of the...
Right.
I can't remember any of the... I want to call them the Mujahideen, but that's like now in the Middle East or something.
Right.
It's the protectors of Hamanatra.
Right.
That we later learn he's part of that group.
Okay.
And interestingly enough, winds up giving his life. But... he's trying to convince Evie that this is a waste of time, that other people have lost their lives. And in trying to look at the map, he sets it on fire.
Right.
If you know that he's actively discouraging them,
it
doesn't even look like he's going. It's so obvious in retrospect.
Right.
And that's, I like that a lot.
That is nice. That doesn't often happen.
Because you would not notice that the first time.
Right.
But I'm watching it now and I remember it well enough. And it's like, oh, he's setting that on fire. That's what that is.
But
that's
these kind of roller coaster movies are seldom designed to be seen more than once. And they're certainly not designed to be to reveal new things on a second viewing, but most of the time. So it's nice that this one is.
And speaking of scene, you'd agree, the production design of this film.
Yes. Again, and maybe it's just because I've suffered through, and Stephen Sommers hasn't actually worked that much. He did the sequel. He did Van Helsing, he did G.I. Joe, and I think G.I. Joe went really badly for him. Like, I think he might have actually been taken out of the editing room. And then he made this movie a year or two ago called Odd Thomas.
I didn't know that was him.
Yeah, I'm pretty indifferent, bordering on dislike, but whatever.
I remember the first time you saw it.
It's different for him. I mean, it's certainly scaled way back, and it's based on a Dean Koontz book, so how good can it really be? But, so he hasn't worked that much, but his other movies have been so garish and over the top and expensive but cheap looking, and they've been so kind of not good that I think it colored my memory of The Mummy. And so then I go back and it's like, well, this movie's positively stately. This movie is
That's a good adjective for it. It's like, this is what happens where, if you're patient enough, all the pieces come together in the right way.
Yeah.
And it's very similar to my reaction the first time I saw the first Pirates movie.
Yes. That's a good comparison.
You know, this is what going to the movies used to be. It was this sweeping adventure, and it was a story being told to you by people who had some idea of how to tell a story.
Yes, and it gives you characters to care about, and it uses special effects well. I mean, Pirates really does that, and this movie does too. That's a really good point of comparison, because again, every Stephen Sommers movie after this, and even before this, and I like Deep Rising enough, but it's goofy and kind of dumb, you know. Have you seen that one?
No.
Treat Williams underwater with the giant monster?
Well, just Treat Williams underwater makes me want to see it.
It's worth seeing, but it's goofy and dumb. It's Stephen Sommers making an old monster movie without sort of the... It's not the same kind of affection. Whatever.
Because the last time Treat Williams was in the water, it was The Phantom, and everyone knows what we think of that movie.
We're going to the... Shit. What is the line? Isn't it exciting? We're going to the Devil's Vortex! It's so great.
And when he tries to bargain with the... Hey, Drax! He's like holding up two of the three skulls. Like he's a TV pitchman.
That movie's fun.
One other thing I wanted to bounce off of you.
Yes.
Because I thought this was very interesting. And I am incapable of making this observation because I'm a straight male. My wife watched it with me this morning. Drinking coffee, by the way.
All right,
proving
good,
that,
good.
But it was safely on the little table during the boo scene. My wife said it's interesting that from the minute they open it up, they even describe him as being gooey or moist, or they use an adjective, and it's,
those are all horrible words.
It's really, I know you don't like moist, that it's horrible. And then I think it really shows intelligence that it slowly becomes this other thing, and you get several different stages of regeneration. So it's visually interesting because it keeps changing. Even the scene in that room where he's wearing the black mask and the black robes, and you're wondering when he looks like a nerd. But my wife said it's so interesting that once he's fully formed, he's a really good-looking guy.
Okay. He's never done much for me, Arnold Vosloo.
Well, again, but he's not grotesque.
He's fine, but he's never stood out to me as like, oh, wow, what a handsome man.
And he's certainly in good shape, which sort of made me think, well, now you know his motivation. Because if I look like that, I'd want
to
go back
to that.
I want to go back to that, too.
I also think I really like the idea watching it last night. I watched it, and I'm not a fan of like the other American characters, and they're all so generic, and it's fun to watch them get, you know, turned into raisins.
Though,
but
I did give the film credit for having more characters rather than fewer.
Right.
Because lately, there's not enough characters in movies. Every movie is... Well, think of Tusk.
Right.
It's a very small universe.
Yes,
because
but
it's
that's,
a,
part of that is just really financial. I mean...
True. But it made me appreciate the fact that The Mummy has extra characters.
Well, this idea of, as I was watching it last night, I was like, hey, it could have just been this movie where they're running around trying to stop this mummy guy. But instead, it turns it into sort of this cross-country race movie where they have this bet and, hey, well, we're going to get there first. And the middle section is, it's a mad world. I mean, not with a mummy. And again, we see so many movies that are barely one thing. That isn't it great to see a movie that's a couple different things?
That there's too much going on, which is preferable.
But not too much in the way that Stephen Sommers would later fall victim to.
Because here's another example of what you're talking about. Layered in with all this other stuff that we're talking about, and I think very cleverly, is the seven plagues of Egypt.
Right.
And they're worked in.
Right.
And it's not.
Right.
You could see that being the sole focus
Absolutely.
Of the middle part
yes.
of a worse movie.
Right.
Oh, this is the flies.
We
got to
do this. Right. Right. And I was watching it wondering, they're very clever to reboot The Mummy in this way. And again, I know that now, originally they were going to do it much more seriously, much more scary. And now they're talking about doing that again. I think they want to redo. And I think one of these awful people, Kurtzman or Orsi, is attached to oversee all of that. I just think, certainly there's a way to do any of these movies as sort of a fun adventure film, but I feel like if it had been Frankenstein's Monster, if it had been Dracula, if it had been the Wolfman, I don't think any of those lend themselves to that treatment, but I feel like you and I would have bristled a lot more. Like, just fucking do Dracula.
Now this,
but the Mummy, like, no, this, you're okay doing the Mummy differently.
This is uniquely suited, and you could almost see this as Stephen Sommers' very elaborate refutation of what some people's objection to the Mummy
exactly.
is. It's so really slow.
Yeah.
What? You could just run away.
So it's kind of okay to do it this way.
Because this Mummy's terrifying.
Right.
For five different reasons.
And he reimagines the Mummy to the point where we don't get a guy really in bandages stumbling around. I mean, he does it in this very different way, and it works. And that's amazing.
This Mummy gonna fuck you up.
Again, we are big fans and sort of purists of Universal Monsters, and so the fact that he's able to do it and make it work to our approval, which is really all that matters.
Yes, and it's even more amazing because I don't know how many bad movies it's going to take. I, Frankenstein, and
I haven't seen it,
and this Dracula thing that's coming.
Dracula Untold, finally.
What?
Finally, we're going to hear the real story.
Who are these movies for?
I don't know.
The Frankenstein thing was not a success.
No.
So,
but this was already obviously in the pipeline, and it looks very expensive because they're using all that bad Stephen Sommers CGI. I don't know.
And it's so much scarier when someone becomes 100 bats or 1,000 bats than just one bat. One bat is your father's Dracula.
Your father's a pussy. I don't know. You liked the Joe Johnston Wolfman more than I did.
But for reasons, for those of you who have not listened, that was my first podcast.
That was. That's back.
I was like 12. I was like 12 years old.
2010. That was early in the site.
Patrick offered me some candy to get in his van.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was expecting, but there was sound equipment in there.
Yeah, no, that's my move.
Let's
record a podcast. It'll be our special game.
And if you tell anyone about the podcast, I'm going to hurt your dog. As I explained on the podcast, I'm not suggesting that film is without. I think that film has its flaws.
Yeah.
Specifically in the last half hour. But what I liked best was that it took me to Universal Town. Right. It took me to Monsterville. And it let me walk around a little bit. Do you still think it's largely worthless, or would you concede that there are a few sequences that work?
No, there are some things that work. There's some good production design. Emily Blunt is good.
It's clearly closer to Van Helsing than The Mummy.
Yeah.
If you want to see it as a scale of here's where it goes off the track.
But there just have been so few actual successes at trying to reboot any of this
Jack
stuff.
The Jack Nicholson Wolf.
Oh,
and
that's good. Well, I need to re-see that.
You see them, they keep trying, like every 10 years.
Well, no, in the 90s it became very popular, and I don't know if it was just the success of one movie, if it was just Bram Stoker's Dracula. I feel like they were all already in production, because they all came out pretty close together, where you had A-list filmmakers remaking classics. So you had Bram Stoker's Dracula, you had Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, you had Mary Riley.
Yeah.
Stephen Frears doing, or was it Neil Jordan? Neil Jordan.
Doing
Mary Riley.
Jekyll and Hyde.
You had Wolf. So it was very popular, but none of them worked. I mean, I have some positive things to say about Bram Stoker's Dracula, but.
As do I.
I don't love it.
It started the biliest trope, there, I said it, that the monster is the misunderstood
Bilious
romantic.
Trope sounds like a Dickens character.
I think it sounds like a band that plays at Cabaret Metro.
Or like a Harry Potter.
On the weekends, but they haven't quit their day jobs yet.
Like a Harry Potter character.
Who's opening for them? Bilious Trope. Because the lead singer's named Billy, and think it's clever.
I like it.
I will be an apologist for Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Sure.
But the thing, and I talked about this in class for 10 years or more, that the monster can't be the misunderstood romantic hero.
Right.
And the hero can't be batshit crazy.
Right.
So maybe that's your spin and you think you're doing something different, but Dracula is an agent of the devil. If you go with him, you lose your soul. If you lose sight of that, something goes dangerously amiss.
Right.
You wind up with Keanu Reeves saying, "Our job is done. Hers is just beginning."
Oh, shit. There were two that I used to say all the time. One was like, "I buried the bastard myself at Carfax Abbey." That was one. But there was another. He's grown young? Was it he's grown young?
Oh, I think I've told this story before. The Criterion Collection Laserdisc, long out of print, had an editing demo where using your remote, you could put different takes of the same scene together in different ways. Have I never told you this?
It was Coppola's early version of Twixt.
No, have I never told you this?
I think you might have.
And like to disappoint you from the get-go, it's a conversation scene between Winona Ryder and Keanu Reeves. So really, you couldn't give
us? Let's see how many different ways we can put this together.
Winona Ryder gives him something different, subtly different in each take, because that's what you do. So they have something to work with.
Right.
In every take, Keanu Reeves is the same leaden, uncomfortable.
He was out of his depth. He has grown into a much more interesting, better actor. Although he gives some good performances in the 80s. By the way, River's Edge is coming out on Blu-ray. I'm so excited. He was the son of a bitch. Ricky Nelson. Like, they would always stick in a lot of those movies, they would stick like a pop star, somebody who didn't fit. Yeah. You know, it's Eli Roth in Inglourious Bastards.
He's stretching.
Right. Sorry. I couldn't come up with Ricky Nelson's name. That's what held up the podcast. The point is that The Mummy is a lot of fun.
And October's just around the corner.
It is. Don't watch The Mummy, though. It barely counts. Barely.
I disagree.
The Stephen Sommers one?
I disagree. I think at its heart...
You can watch it on September 30th. That's fine. Once it's October...
At its heart, it's a horror film.
Fucking get real in October. It's an adventure film with horror elements. Oh, I wanted to say that one of the things that The Mummy does well, you had mentioned that Bram Stoker's Dracula does this thing where Dracula is the misunderstood romantic hero, that actually The Mummy still gives him that thing. He is this romantic, tortured hero, but he's also... an evil son of a bitch.
The Mummy does it right because there's that element, but it's not dwelled upon, and we still hate him and think he's a dangerous
psychotic. He's a monster,
psychotic.
Right, exactly, exactly. Anyway, so watch this on September 30th, and then...
Or October 1st.
Grow a pair of testicles on October 1st and watch some real horror movies.
It's the adventure stuff that, like the comedy in Evil Dead 2, it's the adventure that's the distraction from the horror. It's a horror film with an adventure overcoat.
I love that in the last 10 seconds of this podcast, we totally disagree. Anyway, thank you guys for listening. October's getting close.